Hello there and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Now, Full Chat is powered by Bikeshaw. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikeshaw will tailor a quote to your exact needs, saving you money on your annual moped, scooter or motorbike insurance.
And don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Now, as you know from now, every week we absolutely do our best to bring you a belter of a guest, and we've done it again this week. This man is literally Mr. TV, music, writing, presenting, you name it, he can do it. And he is, of course, the one and only Mr. Nick Knowles. Morning, Nick.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Good, thank you. Thanks so much for joining us. We're excited about this.
I'm excited to be here, actually. Bikes have been sort of love of my life, my whole life. So, it's nice that I always take an opportunity to have a chat about it.
Fantastic. It is. It's a pleasure, Nick. Really appreciate you taking the time. We're going to get stuck into everything bike-related in due course. But the most recent chapter, of course, is Strictly Come Dancing, which looks like an absolute assault on the senses watching it. What's it like on the inside?
It's amazing fun. When I joined it, I thought I'd have to lie all the way through about enjoying myself. Do you know what I mean? Do that showbiz thing where you go, yeah, I'm having a great time. But when you watch it and you see like the dancers or the competitors actually saying, oh my God, my partner is the best person in the world. I can't believe. And you go, yeah, all right, seriously, get out of yourself. But then you get into it and it's like super intense. It's like 8 hours training a day. I mean, literally 8 hours training. I lost 14 and a half kilos in eight weeks.
My word.
8 hours training a day. You're doing it 6 days a week. You barely see your family. And then this weird thing happens where you begin to care. you begin to care about doing the dancing. You don't want to be the joke candidate. And you start to like not want to let your partner down because these are incredible athletes. I mean, that's the thing that I've sort of come to learn. Is these dancers are incredible athletes. And the physicality of what they do is absolutely astounding. Well, it was too much for me. Basically, a combination of... to be fair, that was actually changing a tyre on my car. So that was a little bit embarrassing.
So, what, Nick, just obviously, if you're not watching this, Nick's alluding to his arm. But, I mean... What's gone on there, if you don't mind me asking?
I detached my distal bicep tendon. So basically detached my bicep at the distal, at the bottom end. So I just had that reattached. Amazing. Years of rugby, years of riding motorbikes and having accidents. And then I just changed a wheel on a Range Rover. I managed to pull my bicep off. So that was the first thing. And then a week later, whilst I was dancing... I am 62 and still think I'm 25. So I went for this big leap at the end up the stairs and basically went through my ACL and detached my ACL. So,
what?
Yeah.
So Jesus.
Did a full ACL. But I was like, I was not giving up. I was like determined not to give up. So all the physios were like, you can't dance on an ACL. I was like, well, let's see, shall we? And so the following week, with it strapped to like Robocop, I actually did my final dance and bowed out. So that's how much it meant to me that I was prepared to give it a go on a fully detached ACL.
How embarrassing is this? So you did an ACL and you still lasted longer than me in Strictly. I had no excuse. I was just rubbish when I did it.
Mate, it, like everybody's rubbish when they start.
Oh, yeah.
The first week when I did the group dance, I was about as mobile as a wheelie bin.
It's terrible. I've got to say though, Nick, we've had some really interesting guests on here. And I must say, some people we've had on, I've actually been shocked to think they don't look like they ride a bike. Like I didn't even know they were bikers. But I've got to say with you, and I mean this as a compliment, you look like a biker. You know that you look like a cool uncle, cool brother. You know, you look like a kind of guy that has got a bit of grease on his jeans and knows what he's doing with a motorbike. You look like a biker. I mean that as a cool rock star kind of guy.
Mate, it's very nice of you to say that. You kind of know who you are. This is my list. Actually, I'm going into my 41st, but 40 years basically on TV. In the UK, and during that time, you're very aware. You become very aware of the different types of people, and I certainly don't. I'm not the boy next door. You know, I basically, I've made my living out of looking like a bag of spanners, and people would write to me and say, and say, you look like you always look like you crawled out of bed and had a really good night last night. And that's been the sort of, that's been the overall look that I've got away with for years, which is handy if that's what you've actually done. So, yeah.
I mean, 40 years is staggering. I mean, 25 of those as well with DIY SOS. I mean, it's an absolute mainstay of British television, isn't it? It's a real kind of go-to series that it just ticks so many boxes. And that's possibly why you talk about people getting in touch. It does wonderful, wonderful things, but it drags everyone in, doesn't it? It sucks you into investing emotionally in what you're doing.
I think the thing is, if you've been 40 years in TV, it's because you've like, the trick in TV is to look like you're being really casual, but to know absolutely everything that's going on. Do you know what I mean? You know absolutely everything that's going on. Everything's by design, and you make it all look accidental. Mm. So with me, I mean, I'm very lucky that I get to go on and be me. A lot of people have a personality that they put on for TV. And I'm pretty much the same. You meet me in the street as you meet me on TV. And that's very, I'm very lucky to be in that situation. But over the years, the program has become that thing that, well, it's kind of like, well, there's a lot of TV that's narrow casting now. Do you know what I mean? If you like bikes, you'll watch a bike show. If you watch men's programs, you watch a men's program. If if teenage programs, the kids go off and do something else. There's very little that the people all sit around the TV as a family and watch. And weirdly, one of them is Strictly, you'll get the family sat around to watch, or X Factor maybe, but SOS is one of those things too, because there's enough emotion and human fortitude on show for those who like that kind of stuff. There's a real sense of community and the sort of Amish raising a barn of people coming together, reassuring you that there
takes
are
a village.
Yeah. They're reassuring you that in every community there are nice people out there, more nice people, and the news makes us think that there aren't. Mm. And then there's enough comedy and ripping the piss out of each other as builders to make sure that it doesn't become an hour of Simon Bates Our Tune, which it could do if you're old enough. Mm. I don't suppose either of you are old enough to remember that.
Yeah.
But you've got to have the comedy in there because you can't have constant emotion. So it's been that sort of lucky accident that we discovered this format with this bunch of people, and the audience have loved them and stuck with them after over all this time. But you're right, we're not very sort of celebby. We like people will come up and say, I'd like to buy you a pint, or will you come over and give my missus a cuddle because she likes your program, and things like that. It's kind of weird, you know. But it's very sort of friendly, and people will chat in the supermarket.
Inclusive, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's the fact that the team, you clearly all get on well. And I remember many years ago, I did a one-show feature, and it was in a street in Manchester, and you were doing the whole road up for veterans, for soldiers who were injured. And I remember you weren't filming that day, but genuinely everyone was saying, oh, he's really nice, they're all really nice. And I think that comes across on the screen. And you say you've been in the industry 40 years. It's because you're a nice guy and because people can see that. I think people whose careers come and go are those people who you can see through it. And DIY SOS is such a lovely program. And with great people, you must feel immensely proud of what you've built there.
I'm immensely proud of all the people that have come to build it. I mean, I always remind people of this. The most important to remember is, like, people go, oh, it's amazing what you do on DIY SOS, and it's lovely that they say that. But there's only six of us, and every build we do is like 300, 400 people that come and do it. We don't build it. We haven't built anything. It's the people who turn up in every community we go into. So it's always important. I always make a point of reminding that. And I always say when we make the program, we make the program around the build. So telly thinks it's the most important thing wherever it goes. It always does. But in actual fact, but we do it differently. We say the most important thing is the people who are in need. The second most important thing is the people who turn up to help them. The third most important thing is the build, because we've got to get that done. And then we build a program around that. We don't make the program the first thing, most important thing we do. The other thing is, like, you look at other TV presenters, they'll go along to do their job, like, on a building site when they're a presenter, and they'll sit in the porter cabin reading magazines until it's their turn to come and do a piece to camera. Yeah. I've never understood that. I get bored off my tits doing that. I literally, so I go out, and I'm 8 o'clock till 10 o'clock at night. I'm out there chatting to people, having a coffee, going and making coffee for people. If I'm not filming, I'll go and make coffee. I'll say, because I like people. And that's the other weird thing. A lot of people who do what I do for a living don't like people. Yeah. It's weird, but I really like people. I love chatting to people and finding out about people. So, yeah, I think you only get out what you put in. And if you put in, like, effort to get to know people on site and make them feel valued, then at the end of the job, that's why they all look so emotional at the end. It's not just the smell of the builders after 7 days working together. It's because they feel genuinely engaged with the project and feel it's their project.
Nick, if we can rewind a little bit then and go back to your love of bikes. I think one of your first ever TV jobs, I think, was it Ridge Riders and Meridian? It was bike related anyway. And as I said, when I introduced you, you look like you were born attached to a motorbike. You really do. Yeah. Where does a love affair with motorbikes for you start then? Has it been from a young age or...?
Yeah, well, I grew up in, as I say, in London, in West London, and then basically my dad was on and off the, like, having affairs in various places, so we moved quite a bit to get away from people.
God almighty.
and we moved up, my family won't like me saying that, but it's the truth. So we moved up to Suffolk for a couple of years to get away from everything. And whilst I was there, I used to go hay baling. Oh, this is like this long-winded turnabout story, but basically, and on this farm, they had an old Honda C90. And me and my mate, when we were like 13, 14 years old, used to bomb around on this Honda C90 in the fields. So, yeah, the Honda C90 was my first old rusty old nail that I used to have fun on. And that sort of also started a love of like off-road as well, like dirt track and things like that. And then after that, it was I got my first bike when I was able to, when I was 16, in the days when you used to be able to have a 250 when you were on a learner license, which is great. Yeah. So my first one, because I'm a big unit, I'm 6'2" and 48 inch chest, so I'm a lump, you know, 17 stone. So an FS1E was never going to be the thing for me. It was all too little. So I got myself a Honda Dream, not the Super Dream.
Yeah, yeah.
The Dream, which had a lovely big sort of pear-shaped tank, looked a bit like the Honda CX500, that kind of... It was about the biggest 250 you could get. And I used to bomb around on that, and that sort of started my love affair with motorbikes, which I continued on. And then when I went to Australia and started my TV career in Australia, and when I came back to the UK, I was working for a company, and I said, we should do this like history programme going on the ancient trackways, which are open to... Byways open to all traffic, BOATs they're called. And do some like and get some vintage motorbikes. We did three series of that motorbike, four, maybe five series of that using all kinds of different celebrities who were bikers. And we just went off and toured along these, did a bit of history, did a bit about the motorbikes. And I basically, it was an excuse for me to ride every bike I'd ever wanted to ride.
Can you remember what it was like to get that pass mark from the examiner and then suddenly that feeling of freedom, which opened the door to all these bikes and adventures that you're talking about?
It was just wonderful. And the thing was, you did things then, like things then that I would never do now. And I think that's just basically the excitement of youth and stupid stuff. Like, I remember, like, when I passed my test, the first thing I did, it was a really hot summer's day, actually. And I'd literally put all the kit on to pass the test. But then, because it was a lovely hot summer's day, I literally got down to a pair of shorts, helmet and a pair of trainers and got on the bike and rode from Tunbridge Wells to Brighton and back just because it was a beautiful day.
Yeah.
And like, I have to tell you, I honestly mean, I'm not just going to say this because it's the health and safety thing to say. After all the accidents I've had, I wouldn't dream of going on a motorbike now without a full set of leathers and knee protections and a full face helmet and all the rest of it. Because I had an accident where I took the chin guard of a full face helmet, and the idea that if I'd been wearing an open face, that what would have been the alternative?
Well, you wouldn't be talking to us now for a start, would you? Let's be brutally honest. Bloody hell.
No.
That's your moneymaker, isn't it? That's the moneymaker. You can't damage that.
Well, I know a lot of people would say it could only improve the situation. but I tell you what, this is funny. My first accident was when I was 17 on my Honda Dream. And I wasn't really paying as much attention as I should have done and realised I'd just overtaken a police car. So decided, rather than stopping, to get away. Basically went down a road that I thought was a through road, but actually turned out to be a cul-de-sac. But I only found out about 40 metres short of the end of the road that it was a cul-de-sac. Anyway, I had a big accident down there, damaged the bike, got up, the ambulance turned up. Somebody called the ambulance, they'd heard me come down the road. And I, as you do when you, I don't, you probably both had accidents, but you're basically full of adrenaline.
Mm.
So I sent the ambulance away and said I was fired. It was only once, God, I realised I'd taken my kneecap off on one side. So... I got taken into a house next door and rang my dad, who had a Fiat 127, a little old hatchback. You remember those?
Yeah, yeah.
So he came out to get me because we couldn't get an ambulance. And when he got to me, they couldn't stand me up or do anything because of this kneecap. So what they did, so the guy just changed his front door. So they took his old front door that was in the front garden, laid me on that and shoved me in the hatchback. And my dad drove me up to hospital with my legs hanging out on the door. This hatchback, yeah.
I thought you were going to say the guy took a hammer, he just finished his dude, and he knocked your kneecap back into place or something.
No, I had it sewn on that night, actually. Oh. It's amazing. So that was when I was 17, played rugby, had all kinds of sports career, all the rest of it. And it's weird now that I'm 62, when it gets cold, that kneecap hurts. It never gave me any jib all my life, and now it's starting to hurt again.
But I tell you what, in a weird way, does it give you a little smile like it does now, reminiscing about that story? I know it's a bad story, you got hurt, but I love thinking back to my youth, good and bad, you know, and memories on a motorbike for me, it always makes me smile, unless you're getting hurt. But you know what I mean? But motorbikes are brilliant.
Yeah, but even getting hurt, everything, like all the various bits that I've hurt, falling off a truck in Africa or doing whatever, rugby injuries, I consider them all badges of honour. So you can either become a martyr to your injuries, and there's a lot of people you meet who the most interesting thing about them is their illnesses. You know what I mean? Yeah. The kind of people that when you say, how are you, actually tell you what you didn't.
Yeah, I don't mean how are you. It's just a thing to say. Yeah. Don't tell me how you are.
Yeah, I'm not really interested, thanks very much. And the most interesting thing is not the selection of pills that you take every day. Yeah. So for me, they're badges of honour. It means I've lived a life, you know. Mm. I've got a scar over my eye. I've got, you know, all the various different injuries. But these are all stories of things that I've done and places I've gone and adventures I've been on. So, yeah, I think you can become a martyr to them, or you can just, like, get up every morning and just try and get everything working again. I mean, it's a slower process getting up in the morning now. Like, you get up and everything aches, but then you're
check
an athlete. You're an athlete, so I presume you're screwed anyway.
Everything's broken on me, and you, Pratt.
I tell you what, Nick, he does give it a go, though. I mean, this man's non-stop. I tell you what, let's just do a quick bit of mid-show housekeeping. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. That was just a way of me gathering my thoughts after the kneecap story. You went over to you, mate.
One of the common things we find from most people we talk about is the beauty of being on a bike is you put that crash helmet on and you can be anyone. You can go anywhere. I mean, you're obviously a very recognisable guy. Firstly, what freedom does that give you when you can jump on a bike, put the visor down, no one can see you? And secondly, when you do turn up at a petrol station or you're going to a gig and you take your helmet off, and people are, bloody hell, Nick Knowles, I didn't know you'd ride a motorbike. Or do people associate you as I did as a biker?
I don't think anyone's ever been surprised. No, that's not true. I used to follow the MotoGP and the superbikes around quite a lot. I'd go to a lot of the events with people like, there was a really lovely group of people that I used to do it with, Keith Flint, Ewan McGregor, Charlie Borman, who else used to come along on things like Gordon Ramsay, all big bike fans, all people I knew sort of through biking. And that was interesting if you turned up for a bacon sandwich somewhere with the helmets coming off one after another. That caused that would cause a few surprises. But
Nick, in that, sorry to put in, but you mentioned people there that are, and some quite frankly, very, very famous people, but I presume once a helmet comes off, it's all bike chat. It's not necessarily, oh, I thought Star Wars was great, or what's your next restaurant going to look like? I presume it's like looking at each other's bikes and shooting the shit about that type of stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an escape from pressure. I mean, to be fair, yeah. Gordon used to come along to the superbikes. I'd get him into the superbikes, and then because I was dating somebody that was big in superbikes, and so I was sort of involved in the circuit. And I used to get Gordon in, but Gordon would arrive really excited about the bikes, would start to watch the race and then fall asleep on the infield because he was like so knackered from like his other businesses. So mostly a chance for him to fall asleep. Charlie Borman and Ewan McGregor, obviously, were big buddies anyway. If one or the other of them came to the superbikes, they would ring the other and FaceTime them and go, I'm at the bikes you on. And on one occasion, when I was over in Laguna Seca, I'd gone over to watch the MotoGP in Laguna Seca. I was in the pit lane, And this huge phalanx of photographers comes down the road along the pit lane towards us in the sort of public area. And in the middle of it was Ewan McGregor, who leant over and said to me, Nick, can you get me into the one that I probably, to be fair, I think probably shouldn't be too difficult. So, I asked my oppo, and she got him through. And then he was like, can I have a photo with this rider? Can I have a photo with this? Can I have a photo with that? And then he turns to me and he goes, would you mind coming up to the stand? I've got my mum and dad in the stands, and she's a big fan of DIY swear. So we got there, and Ewan McGregor's taking photographs of me and his mum. I'm like, this is really, really weird. So biking is that thing. Biking, yes. It's a bit like it used to be like hanging out in the smoking area. There is a certain type of attitude, and biking is a similar thing because we all know it's dangerous. We all know it's a more dangerous form of transport. It's a life decision. It's not just the choice about your mode of transport. And I think you get a certain type of person that makes the decision to make that part of their lifestyle and accept the various risks that go with it in order to have the freedom it gives you.
Yeah. Where are we at in the present day then, Nick, in terms of bikes? Obviously, we can see people aren't watching, your arms in a sling. You're knocked up at the moment. But what's your current bike? Do you have one?
I don't at the moment. I'm between bikes, as they say. So, and I'm not sure which way I'd go at the moment. I did sport bikes a lot. I used to really enjoy. I had Hondas for a long time. I rode a lot of basically the 600s. I always thought I was never one for the massive engines. You know, the 1200s and those kind of things. I think once you get up to 600, that does all you ever want to do. My F Sport used to do 175 miles an hour. You're never going to need anything more than that. So.
My word.
But now I'm wondering whether the next bike might be, I might settle into something like a bit more of an armchair. Like I'm quite fancying one of the Indians, or rather than the Harley. The Indians are beautiful. The Buells are nice too, and for like what appears to be quite a top heavy bike, they seem to handle. I had a go on one just recently, and they handle really nicely for a bike that doesn't look like it will.
Do you get, because Ewan's mentioned this to me before, and the trappings of his celebrity lifestyle, Nick, do you have people falling over themselves to provide you with bikes to mess about on and test out and take for a ride and use for a bit?
You can get them. I mean, like, you know, there are various ride outs and things where people will provide you with a bike or organise a bike for you. And certainly I was in America recently and managed to do a ride along the Mississippi on a Harley with a group of Harley riders. They brought a Harley along for me, and there is something a bit special about riding alongside the Mississippi with a Harley and a group of other riders. There's sort of something iconic about that. So yeah, you can do, but by the same token, but weirdly, the British bike manufacturers are rubbish by comparison to other, like the Japanese manufacturers. Mm. I mean, even when Charlie and Ewan started to do the long way down, they approached British manufacturers who wouldn't lend them the bikes. And of course, and BMW were like, we'll give you whatever you want. And the Japanese companies will go, yeah, we'll give you everything. Mm. The British companies are still a bit behind in understanding where their opportunities lie.
I think as well that, I mean, I presume, and having seen, all, like you say, with Ewan and Charlie's various long ways, the boom in BMW adventure bike sales off the back of that really does speak for itself, doesn't it? I mean, what's the best way to show what your bike can do? Get someone to ride it around the world and get all the way around the world and make sure they get back in one piece on a machine that's built for that type of thing.
Well, you've got to wonder how that meeting went when they approached the British bike manufacturer and they sat in the room and went, so, okay, so you've got an international film star who's known worldwide and he wants to ride our bikes on a... Yeah. And they go, I don't think this is for us, do you? No, I think I'm not sure what we get out of this.
But now it's... And you mentioned the Mississippi and a Harley. So what we normally do at the end of each episode is ask our very special guest about a fantasy ride. So now it's fantasy ride time. So we're looking for your idyllic mental image of riding off into the sunset. Where are you going? Who are you with? What are you riding? And what are you listening to?
Okay, what am I riding is the one I'll do first. So I'll choose. I was very lucky when I did Ridge Riders. I got to ride all of the bikes that I ever wanted to ride. The Scott's, Vincent's, rib, Riley's, Scott's. I mean, like every kind of vintage bike I ever wanted to. So I'm going to choose a Brough SS80, a Brough Superior.
Nice.
Which was the ultimate British motorbike. It was the one that Lawrence of Arabia used to ride as well. And the one that he raced an aircraft at Salisbury on Salisbury Runway, long before Top Gear even thought about it. He raced a biplane on the runway at Salisbury on a Brough Superior. So, but they're about 250,000 each, I think, now. There's like, you can pretty much name your own price for one of those. They're so rare. God. So maybe I'll borrow it instead. But,
yeah, get it heavily insured and borrow it.
Yeah, and where am I going? Cornwall, probably. I love Cornwall. I mean, I know there are exotic places around the world, but I think when the sun's shining, there's nowhere more beautiful than the UK. And there's a beach down in Cornwall called Trebarwith Strand, where I used to, when I had my sort of dark dog days when you just feel like the world's like on top of you, I used to ride down there and park up and go up onto this rock, which there's like a ledge that you can get cut off by the tide. It's up on a cliff, but you're stuck there until the tide goes out again, and it was a way to slow my head down.
Nice.
So that's probably where I'd go.
Are you going solo? Yeah, are you going solo? Have you got a companion? And are you listening to your own music or other music?
Well, plainly, as I'm getting married next year, I would want the love of my life, my fiance, to be on the back of the bike. What are you trying to get me into trouble? Like, I almost fell for the I'd be going on my own routine there. No, so obviously I'd like to take my fiance with me, and maybe instead of it being a contemplative rock, we can turn it into some kind of other hideaway.
The love rock.
Yeah. And the music. You know, that varies all the time. I have the weirdest collection. I think because I write dramas and movies and things like that as well now, I think that my head is so full of all kinds. Like, my car's got all kinds of weird stuff in it, like movie scores by Hans Zimmer and things like that. So, I don't know, something dramatic. I tell you what, if it's the big riders that are listed, I'll go for one of the theme from Gladiator. There you go.
That's like that.
That doesn't get much more butch than that, does it?
the theme from Gladiator with your best girl on the bike, on the back of the bike. That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
With a very expensive bike. And you could be riding, you could be going to your wedding day. That could be it. You could be going through to your wedding, listening to your music with the missus. On a £250 bike. That's good.
And after being on the Rock of Love.
It is vintage. I mean, it is, yeah. It's, I think that's probably where I go. I think that would probably be it. But look, that's the thing. So many bikes, so little time to ride them all.
Yep. But it's your dream ride. You know, that everyone's given a different answer, and it's so personal to you, and it's where you want to be, and it's great.
Have you two said what yours is? What's yours, Ian?
I don't know what I'd be. I've got an old Harley bobber, so I need to get that going again because the battery's flat. So I'd probably go on my bike. I'd have to do America somewhere on the coast, and I'd probably have a shuffle of like 80s rock music just to bring back my youth. And like you said, visor down. I'd love it.
That beats that cliff run that you see in all the movies from Santa Monica along there is a perfect bike run to do.
Gorgeous.
That's your spot to pick if you're going to do it.
Yeah, you get the weather there as well. I was fortunate enough to do that PCH ride a very, very long time ago, and it was absolutely everything that I thought it would be. It's like sitting in the middle of a movie soundtrack and film set and going, this is absolutely amazing. And it goes back to what you said, Nick, about making sure that there's different terminology for it nowadays, but it's the very definition of mindfulness, isn't it? Being in the moment, enjoying that moment, and whether that music is the right music. So if you've got the Eagles on or that, it's just... It's transformative and it transports you, really, doesn't it? In a literal sense, being on the bike, but also in a kind of mental and emotional sense as well.
There is a very sort of Zen thing about being on the bike and in the moment. And those experiences are special. Whether you're, I mean, I got very lucky. I did a whole load of travel programs, and last year one of the things I did was to go camel herding on a motorbike in the Mongolian desert. I mean. And there was a moment where the bloke's screaming at me in Mongolian because one of the camels has got away and I can't round this little bugger up. He won't go where I want him, and I'm going round and round him on a motorbike. And I'm having the time of my life. I'm just having the time of my life on this rusty old nail of a bike. And it's as much fun as I've ever had on a motorbike on an horrible old nail. But I mean, that's the thing about biking, experiences and, and you know, places. I years and years ago, I was doing a thing about, there was a whole bunch of people that there was, I think Texaco or one of the oil companies basically managed to get hold of all the land that it took out of the oil out of in America. And it turned out that land was originally owned by a horse thief who owned it, but was hanged for rustling. And so his descendants essentially owned the land that, that this oil company had been taking all of the oil out for the last. And so they had you know, billions of pounds they were suing for. We went over there to see them and I took over this bike. Anyway, I took over this genealogist. It was like a posh lord or somebody other. And we ended up in a biker's bar, as I usually end up in a biker's bar. We're drinking Jack Daniels to the early morning, playing pool. And he was the Earl. That's right. He was the Earl of somewhere, but they thought it was his first name, Earl. So they kept on calling him Earl all evening. Anyway, end of the evening comes, and they basically, I've been doing this Ridge Riders where we've been riding all these old bikes, and you'll know if you've ever had a vintage bike, each of them has their own little thing. You have to tick all the carbs, you have to advance retard, you have to have more arms than you actually have, especially if it's got a stick shift or a suicide clutch. It's like, so I've learned all this stuff. Anyway, we get to the end of the evening, and we're all a little bit half cut. The bikers all decide that they're going to take off, but they go to take off, and one of the Harleys won't start. It's a candy twist fork Harley, like proper long.
Yeah.
You know, with eight hangers, the bars and everything. So I said to them, I stood there next to them watching them, and I went, why don't you jumpstart? And they went, you can't jumpstart a Harley. I was like, watch me.
Watch this.
So I got on and jumpstarted it. Well, these guys were like, oh my God. Like, the limey actually jumpstarted a Harley. Where are we going to drink? So I took them all to my hotel. I've got to tell you, the night porter at my hotel when I turned up with 35 Hells Angels.
Face dropped.
And he said, they're not coming in. And I was like, well, there's two ways this is going to go. You're going to serve them a lot of drink and they're going to give you a lot of money, or they're going to come in anyway.
My word.
I'll tell you what.
I got a jacket out of that. I actually got a Hell's Angels jacket out of that, which they gave me, which they gifted me for jumpstarting their bike.
Nick Knowles, the patched in Hell's Angel. That if that's not an image to finish a podcast on, I don't know. Because I mean, sadly, Nick, that's just about it for this week's full chat. It's powered, of course, by Bikeshaw, as UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker. Bikeshaw will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your annual bike, scooter, or moped insurance, and so much more.
Honestly, a huge thank you to today's special guest. Your life is like a strange dream. I mean, rustling up camels.
Fever dream.
Yeah, your biking life has been absolutely brilliant, Nick. So thank you very much. The one and only Nick Knowles. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Nick. You've been a legend. Don't forget to press the subscribe button on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Thank you so much for watching and listening. Until next time, goodbye.